Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now in the studio is Barry Eisler, who was for 3 years a covert operator in the CIA's Director of Operations. Then he worked as a technology lawyer and startup executive in the Silicon Valley and Japan. Eisler's best-selling thrillers have won the Barry Award and the Gumshoe Award for Best Thriller of the Years. He has been included in numerous best-of lists and has been translated into nearly 20 languages. Welcome to Background Briefing, Barry Eisler.
Thank you, Ian. It's good to be here.
And your latest book, The Detachment, continues your character's, John Raine's reign of, of terror.
Well,
anti-terror, I guess.
It depends on how you look at it, I guess, because he is an assassin and his specialty is making it look like natural causes. So you can imagine his services are in demand by many governments.
And in terms of the way Washington works, it's pretty clear that the Congress has become the servant of the oligarchs, and I suppose to some extent the executive branch as well. When you were in the agency, was the national security establishment, is that also a servant of the oligarchy?
Yes. When you think about an oligarchy, I think the correct way to look at it is as a kind of informal nexus of various power centers who, rather than competing, find that their power and privileges and status is best preserved by various forms of informal cooperation. So here we're talking about politicians, the military, corporations, banks, and the establishment media.
So Barry, let's talk about The Detachment. The story is how your hero is tasked to essentially stop a coup. We're talking about America being an oligarchy, and of course the bad guys in your book are referred to as the oligarchy.
Right.
But there's already been arguably a silent coup in this country.
Yes, yes. And a former, am I the head of the IMF, a former head of the IMF, Simon Johnson, wrote an article in The Atlantic, I think it was in April 2009, and it was called The Quiet Coup. And anyone who's listening, if you're interested, just Google The Quiet Coup Oligarchy or Simon Johnson, The Quiet Coup, Atlantic, any of those words, and you'll find that article. And it was a huge eye-opener for me because we're not used to thinking of ourselves as being governed by an oligarchy. There's just an inherent psychological resistance to recognizing certain structures and behaviors in your own culture that it's relatively easy and even pleasurable for us to recognize in others. So for example, just some trivial examples, we never talk about tribes in America. We don't have tribes, we have factions. Primitive brown skin cultures have tribes while we have factions. We don't torture, we have enhanced interrogation techniques, other bad countries torture. And there are a lot of examples like this about how we protect ourselves from the ugly truth and but have no trouble at all seeing these things in other countries and cultures. I mean, like the New York Times is a great example. Waterboarding, when it's done by Americans, is harsh interrogation techniques. When it's done by China, or when it's done by Chinese or Iranians, then it can be torture. And the term oligarchy, or banana republic, or kangaroo courts, or show trials, these are all words that we exclusively associate with other countries to denigrate them, but it's very difficult for us to recognize simply by the inherent behavior or the inherent aspects of a certain system that these things exist in America today. I mean, the military commissions, for example, you know, the Military Commissions Act. What is the point of military commissions? Jay Bybee, who is general counsel at the Pentagon, actually told his lawyers that we cannot have acquittals. Now, what do you call a trial that is designed to make an acquittal impossible? In the Soviet Union, we call those things show trials. They're intended to provide the kind of a kind of veneer of justice so that you can say, hey, justice was done, while guaranteeing that the accused will be found guilty and punished. We have that in America now, but it's difficult for us to think of that as a show trial or a kangaroo court. Likewise, oligarchy. And reading Simon Johnson's Atlantic piece was a big eye-opener for me. And that concept of America as being governed by an oligarchy has become the backdrop of two books, my previous novel, Inside Out, and now my latest novel, The Detachment. It's not easy, if you're writing thrillers, to use this kind of backdrop because it's not some single evil villain that's fairly easy to use in the thriller structure. Using something that's more of a structure, more amorphous, less personified, is a bit of a challenge for a thriller writer, but a very interesting one for me.
Well, I guess to some extent, Barry Eisler, the scales came off the eyes of a lot of Americans in 2000 in Florida, where it became obvious that the very mechanics of our democracy are akin to a banana republic.
Sure.
But that seems to be deliberate. I mean, and here we are approaching a huge election year where billions will be spent. They'll break all kinds of financial records.
Yeah.
And already 5 million people have been denied the vote, according to the Brennan Center, because of the Republican laws that they've passed. What's your sense, though, of why it is that the Democrats are so supine in the face of this? Or are they kind of oligarch light? Is that what it is?
That's a really good question. And I should say at this point, for anyone who really wants to go deep on this, I have a self-published book that's available on my website, barryeisler.com, and also on Amazon and Barnes & Noble. It's called "The Ass is a Poor Receptacle for the Head: Why Democrats Suck at Communication and How They Could Improve." It's a primer for Democrats on better marketing and salesmanship and how they could, if they were interested, how they could improve their message and sell their policies more effectively. But I think the fact that Democrats do actually genetically suck at communication isn't the real problem. The real problem is a little less obvious and also much more difficult to fix. And the real problem is this. People sometimes talk about how we need a third party in America, but we don't. What we really need is a second party. If you look at the possible spectrum of political choice available to human societies and then place the Democrats and the Republicans on it, you will see that they occupy an incredibly narrow sliver of potential choice. They're basically both pro-war corporatist parties. They are both wholly owned and controlled by corporate and financial America, by Wall Street, by Big Pharma, by Big Oil. Democrat, Republican, it doesn't really matter. In fact, it was a Democrat, Dick Durbin, who acknowledged that the banks own Congress. He said that explicitly. He said the banks own the place. It was a rare moment of political candor. So I think the problem with the Democrats isn't so much that they lack a will to win or they don't know how to communicate. I mean, these things are true to some extent. But the greater problem is this. We see Democrats and Republicans fighting, and the fighting we're looking at, that the fighting that's shown to us is intended to convince us that the fights are real and that therefore we have real political choice. But it's really kind of kabuki fighting. It's the kind of fighting that you might have seen in feudal Europe between, say, the Habsburgs and the Bourbons, right? The wars are real. People really die. They're really fighting. There's real bloodshed. But what the feudal lords of Europe agreed on was much more important than what they disagreed on. And what they agreed on is, hey, we've got a lock on all this. We're the royalty. We run everything. And the one thing we agree on is it's going to be just us. We'll fight hard against each other. But the main thing is to make sure that we keep the peasants down. When you look at the Republicans and Democrats, you can find some narrow differences, but relatively trivial ones in the scheme of things, at least in their articulated positions. But what's more important for each of them is that they continue their lock on power. They continue to trade offices from back and forth from one to the other and exclude anyone else who might come in and actually shake up the foundations of the system that is the source of preservation of their profits and power and privileges and status in America. That's the greater problem, that we have one party that's acting like two and Americans are distracted by that.
When you mentioned, Barry, the idea of to keep the peasants down, you were mentioning it in the context of our global military intelligence footprint. But truth of the matter is we're keeping the peasants down at home.
I
mean, isn't that what the 99% movement's about?
Yes.
The peasants are rising.
Yeah. And any time that the government has ever developed any sort of military or law enforcement or intelligence or security or surveillance mechanism to fight wars overseas, to deploy against foreign enemies, inevitably those same tools and techniques and technologies wind up here at home being deployed against the citizenry.
I mean, we're going to have drones, do you think?
We already do. Google it, domestic drones. It's already happening. And by the way, why is this? You know, follow the money. If you're ever confused about what's really going on, follow the money. I forget what they call it, but military contractors, like any business, are always looking to increase the size of their market. If you can only sell to the U.S. military, that's a big market, but it's limited to one customer, the U.S. military, big as it is. If you can then sell to various overseas markets, if you can sell to the Saudis or to the Israelis or whoever, then you've just increased the size of your market. That's good for you. And if you can start selling domestically, for example, to domestic law enforcement agencies, then you've increased the size of your markets even further. And there's actually jargon, which eludes me at the moment, among military contractors, a euphemistic jargon for the development of their domestic market. And drones are the latest hot thing for various urban police forces. And if you just Google something like urban use of drones or domestic use of drones, you'll see that this is already happening. Drones are already being bought, sold, and deployed here in America. And why is that? To fight crime nominally, to keep us safe from the scary terrorists nominally. But actually, as income disparity gets greater in America, and it's huge now. I mean, since 1980, the top 1% has seen its after-tax income treble. It's increased by a factor 3x since 1980 for the top 1%. The bottom 80% has actually seen its real after-tax income decline. This is not sustainable because everybody knows that this is not the result of some sort of free market capitalistic system. This is a result of a rigged system. Everybody knows it. Eventually, even in America, which has a population that can be shockingly apathetic about these sorts of systems, these sorts of unfair systems and institutionalized corruption and cheating, even in America, you're going to start to see social unrest. And that is exactly what we're seeing now with the Occupy movement. What do you do if you are the oligarchy in the face of this kind of domestic unrest? You have to have the means to keep it down. And that's why police forces are becoming increasingly militarized. You can see this in photographs and video of various attacks in Portland and New York City. And Oakland on the Occupy movements. I mean, look at the police force. Look at the way they're suited up. Look at the weapons and hardware. It looks like something out of Tahrir Square in Egypt or something like that. And the oligarchs in America need the same kind of tools that were recently deployed in Egypt, Tunisia, and elsewhere in the Arab Spring to try to quell urban and popular unrest with a system that the 99% of the population recognizes is inherently unfair.
So Barry Isley, your new book, The Detachment, it's partly set in Japan where you served with the CIA.
I wasn't there with the CIA. I went afterwards on my own.
Okay. Yeah. But what I wanted to ask you, though, is that one of the paradoxes here is that we know during the Cold War, we largely set up these ruling parties in Japan.
Yes.
It's a creature of the Cold War, as was the Italian ruling party.
Right.
And obviously designed to stop the communists and the socialists, because there was a lot, particularly in Europe, because the socialists and the communists were the only ones that fought the Nazis, and there was a lot of goodwill. And
sure.
We were essentially on the side of the oligarchs. But curiously enough, in setting up the Marshall Plan in Europe and in Japan, we didn't necessarily create democracy. We created these one-party rules, but we created social democracies. I mean, the Japanese people have health care.
Right.
And so do the Europeans. So why is it that the American oligarchs thought it was okay for our defeated enemies to have social democracy and not for the American people to have social democracy?
That's a good question. I think probably it wasn't okay is one way of putting it. Indifferent would be another. I think as long as for example, Japan was willing to serve as America's, what did former Japanese Prime Minister Nakasone call it? As long as Japan was willing to serve as America's unsinkable aircraft carrier in Asia, I don't think America was particularly concerned about what sort of health insurance the Japanese government might provide or not provide for the Japanese citizenry. As far as America goes, it's an interesting phenomenon, because you would think, God, the ruling 1% has so much. They've profited so much in the last 30 years. If they could just be a little bit less insatiably greedy and not overplay their hand, maybe they could play this thing out for longer. But instead, I guess this kind of greed eventually erodes your judgment, and nothing is ever enough. So now what we're trying to do here is to cut domestic spending, the Social Security, Medicare, and other aspects of the safety net. But you don't hear any serious talk about cutting military spending, because the oligarchy makes money with military spending and doesn't make money with Social Security spending.
So, Barry Isley, you're clearly a subversive individual because you come out of the CIA and you're writing these books that really do define the true nature of class division in this country and what's happened to our democracy. And in many many ways, it seems to me that these kind of real political discourses, because our media is so controlled by yes. corporations and is so mediated in this phony idea of balance, where yeah. you have to have two sides for everything, as if in the universe of discourse there are, yeah. there's only two opinions.
Yes.
And that's allowed creationism to be equated with
sure.
with evolution, and allowed the global warming deniers to say they're just another argument
right.
against the overwhelming body of scientific argument. Do you really think, though, because I talk to a lot of authors, I talk to a lot of documentary filmmakers, and the impression I get is that in order to get the truth out, people have to do it themselves. You write books, maybe somebody will make a movie out of it.
Yeah.
Feature documentaries happen all the time now, dealing with subjects. Do you really see our mainstream media as having totally failed American democracy?
Oh, God, yes. I mean, it's inarguable to me. If you look at any of the what I call the establishment media, not so much the mainstream media, but the establishment media, look, first of all, look at the ownership. I mean, you can't be owned by a corporate. You can't look at a newspaper or a television station that's owned by a giant corporation and then and also believe, not if you've had any experience in life, but fundamentally, if you're an adult, you can't also believe that this so-called watchdog press will, watchdog media will actually check the people who are in power in America, that it will in fact comfort the afflicted and afflict the comfortable. It's impossible to believe that. They're owned and controlled by giant corporations. And so you have to believe that naturally enough, they will serve a corporate agenda. I think one of the greatest palliatives to corporatist media, to establishment media in America, has been the rise of the blogosphere. And to television and radio stations like Democracy Now!, Amy Goodman's Democracy Now!, which thrive only on user contributions. They are not in any way affiliated with any corporation, and that's why they have their own take on things, because it's not a corporatist take. Or Al Jazeera from the Middle East is also worth watching. I know people are listening and thinking, oh my God, you subversive, you watch, you listen to Al Jazeera. Why not listen to the way other people perceive America at a minimum? I mean, Sun Tzu, know your enemy and you can win 1,000 battles. Don't we want to know the way the rest of the world perceives us? I mean, the founders called that the decent opinion,
of mankind.
Decent respect for the opinions of mankind. Yeah. So yeah, I think the blogosphere has been hugely palliative in this respect. And it is a little bit surprising to me, but not all that surprising, the way certain brands endure. For example, the New York Times is still considered to be the newspaper of record. I mean, Bill Keller is the son of the chairman of Chevron. I mean, come on, what kind of worldview do you expect someone like that to have? I mean, he's no longer editor-in-chief anymore. He recently left. But look at the way the New York Times essentially laundered information for the Bush administration in the run-up to the Iraq War. Look at the way they sat on James Risen's Pulitzer Prize, ultimately Pulitzer Prize winning scoop about the Bush administration's illegal domestic surveillance and wiretapping of American citizens. They sat on that until after the 2004 election. They always called the New York Times, I'm just talking about the newspaper of record, the gray lady, they always called waterboarding torture until America started doing it and the Bush administration started calling it enhanced interrogation techniques. And then in lockstep, the New York Times, and not just the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal and CNN and the Washington Post also, all started calling waterboarding enhanced interrogation techniques. Harvard Business School actually did a study. They did a huge nexus search on how major American media used to describe torture, waterboarding, and other forms of torture, and it was always torture. And then, what a shocker, as soon as the revelations came out of Abu Ghraib and around that time, and the Bush administration started saying, torture, what are you talking about? It's enhanced interrogation techniques or an alternate set of interrogation techniques. All those so-called watchdog media organs changed their nomenclature, actually started using the Orwellian phrases that the administration wanted them to use. And so anyone who thinks that this is watchdog media, and again, Bill Keller at the time, he said, well, we don't like to use Orwellian words like torture. We like to just call it what it is, which is brutal or enhanced or harsh interrogation techniques. And it's like, what are you going to do? What are you going to do next? Call rape unwanted sexual intercourse? I mean, why not? I mean, you wouldn't want to actually use a loaded word like rape, for God's sake, right, Bill? So anyone who thinks that the New York Times or CNN or MSNBC or Fox News, I know, again, people think, oh, Fox News and CNN, they're always going at it, MSNBC, they're always going at it, hammer and tongs. That's real competition. That's real choice. It's not. It's supposed to look like choice. All of them fundamentally serve a corporatist agenda. And if more Americans could be aware of that and listen to the news and watch the news a little more critically, I think the country would be in a lot better shape.
Well, Barry Eisler, I'm afraid we've run out of time. It's been a pleasure talking with you here in the studio. And by the way, we carry Al Jazeera and Democracy Now!
Good for you.
On this radio station. Again, Barry Eisler served for 3 years as a covert operative with the CIA's Directorate of Operations. He then worked as a technology lawyer and a startup executive in the Silicon Valley and in Japan. He's the author of a number of bestsellers, including Inside Out, which won the Barry Award and the Gumshoe Award for the best thriller of the year. And his latest book, just out, both as an ebook and now in bookstores, is The Detachment. Thank you again.
Thank you, Ian.
This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasts, and you can sign up there at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.